morning. Nice to be here. I was duly instructed that if I walked away from the microphone, it wouldn't be recorded. So I assumed that if I wanted to say something we didn't want anybody to know but us, I should walk away from the microphone. But I'll just hold on to it to keep everybody happy. First of all, let me just say again that it's very nice to be here. Thank you. And that I would, while I have some things I would like to share with you and some thoughts and some ideas, what I would also like to do is to give you an opportunity to interrupt me if you are not sure about what I am saying. This is obviously your time, and if you interrupt me, I would rather clarify a point for you than have you kind of go away wondering, what was that woman talking about? Or, what did she mean? Or, I don't agree with that at all. So if you need to ask a question, if I can't answer it, I can't answer them all, but I'll try. And if it's a question you have, it very well may be one that somebody else has. So there are no such thing as poor questions, okay? Now, I'm here today. Oh, one other thing I want to tell you, that one of the great gifts of having such a big family is I won't lose my train of thought. So even if you are trying to get me off the track, I'll get back, okay? All right. I'm here this morning. We're going to be talking, Vince and I, basically three times. And I'm going to be talking to you about development, primarily adult development, but I'm going to go back a little bit and talk about some of our early development relative to relationships, and I'm going to confine myself to mother-child relationships since that's where I have the most experience, and also because I know Vince is going to be talking more about the masculine piece to that. The second piece that I want to do is to talk about stages of development in terms of how adult development interfaces with male clergy. I mean, what are some of the tasks of development, and then what happens when we talk about the developmental processes within the context of being a celibate male clergy. And then tomorrow, what I would like to finish with is to present you with a set of freedoms. Freedoms to be and freedoms to do. And we will go into that a little bit more carefully. Development is always around a certain amount of crisis and always around a certain amount of tension. To develop means to engage in ongoing, life-giving, appropriate processes. And that's very important to kind of hold on to that definition a little bit. You don't have to remember it. There's no quiz. There's no test. But in a sense that it is an ongoing thing, that none of us are ever finished developing. Even though we graduate from school and we celebrate birthdays and we pass various milestones in our lives as we achieve various programs, etc., we are never completely developed. We continue to develop. And that's very important because in our culture, we have a bottom-line culture. We have a culture that talks about things being done, things being the best, things being the greatest, the ultimate detergent, the ultimate car, the ultimate experience. And if you really want to do it and you really want to be it, you want to do this or that or the other thing. And that's very contrary to development, because development is open-ended in some respects. But in other respects, what development is the integration of all the various pieces of us, the physical development, our psychological development, intellectual, spiritual, emotional, as all of those things start to come together and integrate as we reach the second half of our life. I'm glancing around the room, and I think that most of you may soon be close to the second half of your life. A few of you may have already gotten there. But at any rate, development is ongoing processes, all right? And the processes are such that we basically continue to go through the same ones over and over again. So sometimes as an adult, we might say to ourselves, I thought I had this done. I thought I had resolved this. Why am I 55 years old still thinking about this stuff? Why is this issue coming up? Am I being self-indulgent? Am I, you know, just, you know, not grown up? You know, inside of us, we all have this fear that we're really not grown up. And, you know, just what is it? But the reality is that those things occur again and again. And basically, as we re-resolve them throughout our lives. And as each stage of development, when we re-resolve them, hopefully it's a positive resolution, that resolution allows us to more harmoniously integrate that particular experience or that particular reality. Now, two things that I think are important to think about before we start naming processes. One is, why is it so important for us to be talking about development to male clergy? And I think that there are two very important reasons. And I don't think that they should be denied. The first is that at least the male clergy that I'm addressing today is primarily a celibate clergy. And so therefore, you are in a lifestyle that does not provide for you the ongoing challenge and feedback that a married life would. You know, your wives would be challenging you left and right. Not appealing all the time, but God knows, you know, it works sometimes. And so, because we learn things in a social context, we always learn in a social context. New knowledge emerges out of a social context. You say something to me, I say something to you, and we kind of go back and forth, and out of that social context, we learn things. New knowledge, at least for me, at least for you, emerges. Within a celibate lifestyle, very often, that kind of ongoing committed feedback is not happening. And so therefore, because that's not part of the context of your life, now you may have people in your lives who do that for you, and if you do, you're very fortunate, but it's not built into the lifestyle. Because of that, in a sense, it is even more important, it is more critical for male celibate clergy to look at their own development and how their particular development interfaces with what we're doing, and what you're doing, and what you feel called to, and what gifts you want to bring to the community. The second piece to that is, and I think this is a very important one, the second reason that it's so important is that in a sense, you as a male clergy, as a minister of the gospel, as someone who is, you know, particularly if you're working in a parish, although this is not untrue, if you work in a school, or in a diocesan office. But if you're working in a parish, you are frequently called to engage very intimately in the lives of other people. People put down their boundaries and they say, Father, come in. My mother is dying. My daughter is pregnant. My husband is running around. We're worried about this or we're worried about that. And the most intimate details of a person's existence are revealed to you, and you become temporarily a very significant part of that particular family or that particular family system. And then when that situation begins to be resolved, those boundaries go back up. And you're not part of that family anymore. People are grateful, perhaps. They might send you a Christmas card. You might get a poinsettia. I mean, things like that. But you do not remain at that depth of relationship with the family simply because the family system can't tolerate that. And probably neither could you. But the point is that you are called again and again, baptism, funeral, wedding, confession, counseling, etc., first communion, whatever it is, to be intimate and yet remain a stranger in the family. And so that kind of continually inviting you in can lead to a couple of things. Unless you are very seriously looking at your own personal development. Now, one of those things that can happen, And if there are not good boundaries and you are not able to remain real flexible with that, one of those things that can happen, one of the pitfalls, one of the dangers, is to begin to see yourself as a functionary. Begin to see yourself merely as sort of like, you know, a mechanic who comes in and does certain things, and then when the job is done, sort of packs up his tools and leaves. And that kind of mentality is an alienating mentality. That kind of mentality separates you, because in a sense, the only way, if you're going to operate with that mentality, you've got to be separate. I mean, you can't be available psychologically to people if you only see yourself as a functionary. You just can't do it. I mean, you would dry up all too quickly. And that kind of functionary mentality is kind of based on the notion that these people don't really care. All they want is for what I can provide. They want the church's sanction on this marriage, or they want me to decorate the hall after the wedding, or they want me to do this or do that, and they're not really interested in me. Or to say, oh, I've married 200 couples this year, and now I got the 201st, and look, you know, I mean, it's just the same old thing. You know, it can be reduced to routine. Now, that's one pitfall. The other pitfall is to say, can't do it without me, you know? I mean, you know, here I am, lights, camera, action. I am the person that is going to make this happen. I, you know, in other words, to kind of get caught up in that starring role. And to kind of see oneself as a separate and very special and very unaccountable individual. So those would be basically the two ends of a continuum that could occur unless you are always looking at yourself as an intimate stranger, and that intimacy and strangeness as it co-occurs is part of the gift of your priesthood. That you are invited into this intimate experience with the family to bring the gifts that you bring as minister, and to receive the gifts that the family has for you. Not material gifts, but that gift of grace, or that gift of the presence of God in that particular situation. And that you are willing to grieve those continual losses. That in the sense of being part of that family, that intense dynamic during whatever situation that family has to deal with, that when you go back to the rectory, you know, you've had the adrenaline running, and you go back to the rectory and the adrenaline starts running out, and you feel that kind of fatigue that happens when, you know, after you've been into an intense situation, that you are able to grieve the loss, and also to recognize that as part of your reality. Not to turn that into a resentment, not to resent that and say, oh, they're just using me, nor to turn that into an entitlement and say, look at all I did for this family, now I'm entitled to, you know, a little old granddad or a little of this or a little of that, in order to give myself some solace for, you know, the 4,000 units of energy that I provided for that family. But instead to say, that's my reality. And in my reality is grace. I'm only going to find grace in my reality. Your reality is to be somebody who is central and special and a mediator for grace and salvation for these folks. But nobody can be a mediator unless that person is intensely committed to understanding their own particular reality. What is your reality? And that's adult development. Understanding your reality. Understanding who you are, what you are, where you are, and why you're doing it. We always live in multiple realities. All of us. I mean, one of the realities that you're living in right now is whether or not those chairs are comfortable. they look okay. I don't know if they're comfortable or not, okay? Another reality that we're all living in is, you know, whether or not our breakfast and perhaps even last night's dinner settled very well with us. So we're living with, you know, our physical, our present physical reality. We also live with the reality of whatever we vision for the future calling us to. And today in the priesthood, that's a big question. What is the future going to be? You know, is the future going to validate for me what I'm doing today? Is there a meaningful future for the priesthood? That's a big question. A very big question. And we all live also in the reality of our past. The relationships, the history of our family, of all the different kinds of things that we have brought to a situation. And so in those multiple realities, we have to not only visit each of them and be aware of them, but also be very sensitive to how they interact one with the other. Are there any questions at this point? Everybody looks so nice and attentive. Yes. Well, I would call it grandiosity. Okay. The first one would be, you know, they don't really care. And the second one would be, that's what you were referring to? Okay. Okay. Now, our realities, are there any other questions, by the way? No? Okay. Our realities and the processes in which we need to operate are, as an individual, as a developing person, one of the most critical things that I have to come to terms with, that you have to come to terms with, is our place in the world. You know, when we're very young, when we're real little kids, if you watch a two-year-old operate and move around the house and around his family, or, you know, a two-year-old in church, you know, you could have a great homily and a two-year-old can take it over quickly. That basically, as really young children, we see the world as extending from us. You know, we see ourselves as the center of the world. We become sort of the central force, and we assume that everything extends out of ourselves. As we get older and we develop, we become increasingly more interior. And our ultimate goal in development is to recognize that, unlike the two-year-old who sees himself as the center of the universe and kind of like a god, that as we develop, we recognize that we are godlike, made in his image and likeness, but we are definitely not gods. And while that may sound like a fairly elementary thing to say to clergy, I think that that is an essential goal of development, particularly if we are integrating psychological, spiritual, emotional, moral development, because most of us operate for a very long portion of our lives as though we were the God we're worshiping. We look at ourselves as more central, even though, you know, we have a lot of language to deny all of that. Okay. Now, some of the processes that we need to get in touch with as we go forward in our development. And let me just, I see it. Okay. Yes. A question. Tell me your name. Just your first name, Sean. Okay.
Go to the mic, please.
Go to the mic, Sean. This is good, Sean. It gives me a chance to get a drink. Okay.
I just want you to explain a little bit more about most of us operate out of that idea that we're God but not God, or where do we lose it, and like, well, how is it manifested type of thing?
Okay. I think as I talk, some of that might get clearer, but it might not. And if it doesn't, then you just don't hesitate to ask again, okay? Let's see, if I'm all twisted up here, let me untwist. Okay. First of all, let me tell you that a basic paradigm for development, this is just a basic paradigm, all right? There are lots of schemes in development, and later on we'll talk about various developmental stages. But a basic way of understanding development is that development goes from dependent to independent to interdependent. And that no matter where you are, even if you're, say, 45 years old, and you go back to school for a course or two, or you go into a new program, what you are basically going to do, because you are developing a new aspect of your life, a new part of you, you're going to go back to this dependent stage as you begin to take on some of the identity, the new ideas, the new concepts and constructs, as you move forward, as you begin to internalize some of those, then you'll move forward to a more independent stance and hopefully move toward an interdependent stance. So dependent, independent, interdependent does not refer to ages. It refers to basic processes or basic schemes or basic levels of development. So you could be dependent at 30 or dependent at 3, you know, depending upon the context in which we're talking about this. We all start out dependent, and we know that. We start out dependent on our parents for food, for clothing, for shelter, for liveliness, for care. We can't operate independently when we're really young, simply because we just don't have the wherewithal to care for ourselves. Gradually, as we mature and we become more physically independent, we begin to develop a sense of who we are, and we get a certain sense of autonomy. As we develop that autonomy, we begin to take on some kind of our personal power. As an adolescent, one of the big aspects of being an adolescent is to get in touch with your potential power as an adult. And adolescents spend a tremendous amount of time understanding beginning to get acquainted, for example, with their decision-making power and their sexual power and their ability to move about the world relatively freely. As we grow into adulthood and we begin to recognize that the best way and the most effective way to operate is to recognize that we don't live in this world alone, and then we begin to operate, at least at some levels, interdependently. Some of the processes that we have to engage in as we go through that development, however, is to move from early life to later life, to move from a point of view of certitude to a point of view of accepting that there is very little in our lives that is absolutely certain. So if you talk to a really young person, when I talk to a young seminarian, for example, or an adolescent, or a 20-year-old, I live with a lot of 20-year-olds right now. They're a very certain crowd, okay? They have a sense of knowing what happens in the world and the way things should be done and the right things to be done. The only person who is more certain is our 15-year-old, who is absolutely clear, as everything is clear as a bell for her. There are no gray areas. Everything is, you know, do it this way or don't do it that way, okay? Part of development is accepting that while we want to have the world be somewhat invariant, that we want to say, that's the way it is, and then I can forget about that, and I don't have to deal with it anymore, and that's that. That the reality is that the only certainty that we have is that God loves us. The rest of it, we're not really sure. I mean, none of us know that we're going to wake up tomorrow. None of us know that we have everything exactly right. We assume that if we drop something, it's going to fall to the ground, because we know that the laws of gravity are fairly reliable and fairly consistent. But there are very few things that we can say with absolute certainty, because we know if we follow some of the space experimentation, that gravity becomes non-existent at a certain point. So the only thing that we have that we can hold on to is that God loves us. Now, that is a major, major piece in adult development. Because we spend the early part of our adulthood trying to build worlds, trying to build organizations, and which are good. You know, good organizations are very good. Trying to develop structures that, in a sense, captures a kingdom that we're projecting onto a lot of what we want and what we think is good. And a lot of what we think is good is good. But the point is that that certitude is always going to escape us. There is always going to be a certain kind of doubt. There is always going to be a certain lack of absolute comfort in whatever it is that we decide to do. Another aspect, another process that we have to engage in as we develop as adults is to get in touch with our personal authority. To get in touch not only with our personal authority, but with our ability and our responsibility to make decisions and to live with them. Now, when you start talking about personal authority, you know, on one hand, everybody says, well, yeah, you know, that makes sense. You have to make decisions, you have to be responsible, you have to respond to whatever reality is, and you have to engage in that, you know. That makes sense. I don't have any problem with that. But right away, that begins to bump up against our understanding or our comfort with conflict. So that if I am a person who is running around with a belief that says, you know, don't make waves. Don't upset people. Don't rattle people's cages. You know, keep it nice. You know, keep it. Yeah, it'll pass. You know, they'll forget. You'll forget. Don't worry about it. Then my conflictual style or my ability to deal with conflict is going to be seriously undermined. Because in a sense, the only thing, the only choices that I have, if I don't want to make waves and I want to make everybody happy, you know, and I don't want any, you know, God forbid that you might reject me. Oh, that would be awful. That would be terrible. If that's what I'm operating under, then all I can do is be very unassertive and basically be very accommodating. What I'm going to turn out to be is like a bowl of mashed potatoes. You know, I mean, it looks all right. It tastes okay. That's kind of bland. And what I am eventually going to do is build up a residue of resentment over and over again that's going to eventually create a very serious conflict and come out in ways that I will have very little understanding of or control of. And so adult development demands, if I really want to be in touch with my reality, demands that I have a very reality-based manner in which to deal with things that are conflictual. Now, on the other hand, supposing I say, well, I'm not going to be, I'm not going to accommodate you. Not at all. In fact, I think you're dead wrong. I think I'm right. Here I am, again, the center of the universe. Here I am, the God for the God, me. Then I am going to be very, very competitive with you. And not only am I going to be competitive with you, but I am going to continually isolate myself. I am not going to move from being dependent to being interdependent. I'm going to be competitive in my conflictual style. And therefore, I am going to be counter-dependent. If you say yes, I'm going to say no. If you say up, I'm going to say down. Just because that's the only way I know how to define myself. The only way I know how to define myself is disagreeing with everything that everybody else says. And so you hear people sometimes and you think, gee, that guy's really an independent thinker. But you might want to ask yourself whether or not that guy would be a thinker at all if he didn't have something or somebody to oppose. You know, if you take away the opposition, does the guy kind of fall apart? What I failed to say to you before was, if I am an accommodating person, you know, if I'm back to my bowl of mashed potatoes, then basically what I am is very codependent. You know, my neediness and your neediness, and you know, and I can kind of like squish into whatever you need me to be, but again, I'm not being independent because I'm not allowing myself to be me, and if I'm not allowing myself to be me, under no circumstances am I in touch with my reality. I am denying significant aspects of my reality, and if I do that, I cannot grow up. And isn't that what we were all asked to do? Basically, is to grow up. Any questions? Okay. So, yes. The resentment.
Yes, you said that if you accommodate everyone, then eventually you will build up resentment against the others. How was that?
The resentment is because I'm denying my reality, because I'm a living thing. You're a living thing. We are programmed to grow. And if we don't continue to grow, and I don't mean up and out, I mean grow inside, integrate our psychological, emotional, physical, spiritual aspects. If I'm not doing that, then it's going to create an unnatural tension, and that resentment is going to come out. It can come out in alcohol, it can come out in womanizing, it can come out in gambling, it can come out in just being irritable. You know, people that are chronically irritable? You know, people who just simply get up from the minute they get up to the minute they go to bed, it's like it's a rainy Monday morning. You know, even on a beautiful day in May. I mean, that kind of denial of my development will result in a distorted and skewed understanding of my reality, and I am gradually going to become more and more isolated. Because remember, our nature is to be in relationship. That's the natural thing for us to do, to be in relationship. Another process that we have to get in touch with as we develop as adults is our relationship to time. Now, here's a very interesting book out right now. I think it's by Janet Shore, and it's called The Overworked American. Some of you may have read reviews of it or read the book. And basically, her thesis is that Americans are probably the most impoverished people around, because what we have bought into is so much productivity and so much work that we are not allowing ourselves time to be. And so that while we may have very few impoverishments in terms of material goods, as Americans, we have a very serious impoverishment in terms of those things of the spirit, relationships, and, you know, the time for conversation and the time to listen and the time to just kind of think and look at the sunset. That's one understanding of time, how we use time. Do we see time as a resource? Do we see ourselves as a resource? Do we have a sense of stewardship about ourselves and about the time that we have? Another aspect of time that I would like to present to you in terms of an adult process is not just that sense of stewardship of how we use our time to develop, but how we view the past, what our relationship with the past is, how we can operate within the context of our own past in terms of whether we are developing people or whether we remain fixed. I think there are essentially two ways to look at the past. One is like a set of snapshots, things that happened, things that remained, you know, those little snapshots with the white frame around them. I don't know if they still do those, but One time they did. In other sense, fixed. Coney Island. Oh, okay. Fixed. Something that's immovable. Something that's kind of like caught, frozen in time. As opposed to relationship with the past and relationship with time as something that is continuously informing and continuously challenging and continuously inviting us into development. Now, I think there are a couple of ways to look at this. If you take the frozen time model, then you're going to remember things that happened in the past as things in sort of discrete clumps. This happened, this person did this, which was good, that's nice. This person did that, which was terrible, and look at that terrible thing that happened, and here I have this list of terrible things that happened to me. And I have albums and albums of pictures to show you of the terrible things that happened to me. People who were unkind, people who were rude, people who were ingenuine, people who were exploitative, etc. If I use a fixed model of time like that, I remain my own God. I hope this will answer your question a little bit. I remain my own God because I am seeing myself as the standard, whether or not somebody is good to me or not good to me, for behavior. I'm using me as kind of like a model of one, and I'm like a one and only. If, however, I look at time more as an ongoing, informative, and forming model, I look back on things past, and I see the lessons and the gifts that I can learn and the challenges for me to continue to develop. In other words, I am constantly reconciling with my past. I am constantly reconciling with the key players in my past. I am continuously engaging in my own story development because with hindsight, I have a sense of perspective, which is developmental. Now, it does not suggest that things that may have hurt or that were painful were not painful or were not hurtful. But what it suggests is that there is an ongoingness to looking back at the past as a way of informing the present. I'm not gathering a list of rotten things that happened to me. I am engaging in my own development and in my storytelling. Now, I think that is a very... Oh, we have a question. Come forward.
In that process of the hurtful memory, when the remembering comes back, the emotion is about as strong at times. Does the memory ever leave, or is it always there to warn you about what had happened in the past?
I'd hope the memory would never leave. I mean, it's not a question of expunging memory. We're not deleting tape, okay? But we're looking at it and letting go of the hurt. And that's a choice. Ultimately, reconciliation's a choice. A painful choice. And one that does not have a guarantee payoff. Let me give you this example. And this is a little off what I was going to say, but that's okay. It may be worthwhile. Here's an example of, and this is a common example that psychologists work with all the time. You know, you have a guy come see you, and nice person. This could be a married person, this could be a priest, okay? Doesn't matter. Good person, nice, you know, and you say, gee, you know, this guy was my next door neighbor. I'd really like this guy, you know? And he says, yeah, I'm having an affair. I'm having this relationship. I have this woman in my life, and she's special to me, and I really like her, and she's fun, and she makes me feel young, and I feel alive, and it's exciting, and I never knew that life could be like this. This is really nice. And she listens to me, and she understands me. Of course, she's not washing his socks, but that's okay. And I feel alive. And I'm looking back and I'm saying, gee, I went in the seminary when I was 19 or 20 or 22, or I got married when I was 22 or 23 or 24 or 25. And I'm saying, what does a 19-year-old know? What does a 25-year-old know? I didn't know anything about life. I didn't know myself then. Could I have made a valid choice? Was that choice really worthwhile? I mean, after all, now, you look at me now. Now, see, I know myself a lot better now. Did I really make a valid choice? What's best? You know, where should I go? Okay. That's a real dilemma. That's a daily dilemma if you do private practice. And the question there are two things. Number one, the questioner is always asking for certitude. The questioner is always saying, tell me the right thing. And he doesn't want to know the morally right thing to do. He wants to know what's going to make him happiest. Now, happiness, the pursuit of happiness, is a political concept. It is not a psychological concept. It is not a theological concept. And that's a very important distinction to make. So he wants certitude, and he has to grapple with the reality that there is no certitude there. Should he choose to leave his wife, he might, you know, form a good relationship with this woman. They may indeed find, a positive lifestyle together. There's no question about that. And there may indeed really be significant issues in the marriage that fail to meet his needs. Or if he leaves the priesthood, can he form a good relationship with a woman, have children, send them to the local parish school or CCD, be a good contributor, you know, become a lector? Sure. It's true. You know, probably be put in charge of Catholic Charities before long. But the reality is that on either side, there is going to be loss. There is no decision that will not have incumbent loss. And the only resolution can be what that person's understanding of themselves is, and what that person's understanding of what integrity means to them. If you use the pursuit of happiness model, then, hey, you know, the choices, in a sense, aren't too difficult. You look where you get your best shot. If you are looking at your relationship in the context of a larger span, if you are looking at your relationship, say, let's take the husband and wife, in the context of generations to come and generations before, it might be worth going back and seeing if you can work it out. However, you can't make a decision knowing which one is going to have the best payoff. There has to be a certain kind of leap of faith. And that leap of faith has got to be based on your understanding of being a person and your relationship with the God who loves you so desperately. So there is no sure thing, and there is no way without loss. And there is no reality such as we just described without a tremendous gift attached to it. I just, about 6 months ago, worked with a family that was exactly in that dilemma. And the husband sat in front of me. His wife was a peach. And his girlfriend was a peach. I mean, the man had nice taste in men, in women. Really, very nice taste in women. He was a good-looking guy, so it wasn't hard to understand how he was attractive to women. But his decision was to go back to the marriage. Because he said, not because I think that my relationship with my wife is better than that with a girlfriend, because at that time it really wasn't. But because that for me is truest for me. That would be the truest thing for him. That was how he made his decision. And they're doing quite well today, as a matter of fact. That crisis bore tremendous amount of fruit for them. So it's not a question of forgetting. I think forgetting is again, like in another kind of a breadbasket of, you know, Benjamin Franklin kinds of sayings that get mixed up with the Our Father and the Apostles' Creed. Forgetting, you don't want to forget. You want to remember the lessons that that particular situation brought, and you want to grieve the loss. This woman that this guy had fallen in love with was a good woman. She really was. She brought something into his life that was very special and very positive. And she left that good stuff behind. And he took that as he continued in his marriage to grow. And his wife, of course, benefited from that too. So I don't know if that answers your question. Yes? It does? Good. Okay. Another one of the processes that we need to get in touch with as adults in our development is understanding ourselves as competent. What does it mean to be a competent person? Now, this is a very, very important thing, because we have a tendency to be very dichotomous in our thinking. In other words, we're either this or that. Okay, this is a good marriage because nobody has ever flirted with anybody else, or it's a bad marriage because, you know, there was this little flirtation. And that's not a very healthy way to look at things. That's not a developmentally appropriate way to look at things. If you look at things from developmental perspective, you're always, you're always looking in the context of hope, and you're always looking in the context of healing. Okay? So we have a tendency to look at ourselves as being competent or incompetent, and we do not recognize that that is a much more variegated reality. I am competent at some things. Some things I'm very competent at. And other things, I am a complete ditz. Have absolutely no skill, talent, perception, awareness at all. If I look under the hood of a car, I have one desire. That's to close the hood of the car. I have no desire to know what goes on. Why I sit down with my computer, do I care why it works? I could care why, as long as it works. That's all I care about. I have no desire to interact with RAM or ROM or whatever it is. If the keys move and the printout is good, I'm happy. Okay? I have no competence in that. I don't desire any competence in that. But we have a tendency to take situations in which we have either failed or not done real well and tend to let them generalize into our sense of ourselves. So if you walk out of church and somebody says, oh, Father, that was a nice sermon, you know, you say, well, you're just being nice, you know. But if somebody comes out and says, oh, boy, Father, you know, you're real, I was a clunker. Boy, did you know, were you up late last night? You know? Then we have a tendency to kind of say, oh my gosh, I must really be terrible. It's awful. It's like, you know, and let that undermine our sense of okayness. And it's like a virus. It infects the way we think about ourselves. My best example of that is like washing a red sweatshirt with your underwear. You wear pink underwear for months and months. It just hangs around and hangs around, you know. And you see that person, you know, coming up to communion, and you're like, you stiffen. You think, oh, I wonder if they didn't like what I said today. You know, we tend to exaggerate those negative responses because we tend to see ourselves as worthwhile or not worthwhile based on our competence or other person's perception of our competence. The reality is that if you are looking at a developmental perspective and somebody says, I really didn't like your sermon, then you say, well, here's a nice opportunity. Tell me a little bit about why you didn't like it. Person might be way off base. But you engage in that social discourse because it's an opportunity for new understanding and new knowledge. It is not a defensive model. That notion of being competent all the time comes from, I'm kind of rushing here because I know we're getting close to the end, comes from some of those old tapes. We're going to talk a little bit about that later on. Some of those tapes that say, and a lot of us grew up with this, don't disappoint me. Anybody grow up with that tape? You all did, I'm sure. Don't disappoint me. Don't make me feel bad coming from your parents. It's your job to make me feel good about myself because you're my son. And so it causes us to be very, very relentless in our self-analysis and our self-acceptance because we have this fear of disappointing people that are significant and important to us. I'm going to stop because I know that it's time. And let Dr. Bellotta speak, and then this afternoon we'll go forward from here and kind of continue and tie up some of the things that may seem like loose ends. Thanks very much.